Thanks for tuning in to Why Life Science, a podcast produced by the BYU Life Science Museum at Brigham Young University. I'm Katie Knight.
And I'm Austin Lambert. Our mission here at the Life Science Museum is to inspire wonder, understanding, and reverence for our evolving planet. So with this podcast, we are here to bring you stories and interviews about life science research and projects going on in the College of Life Sciences at BYU and in the local community.
Visit our website, lsm.byu.edu, for more information and to access notes from each episode.
Well, welcome back to the Why Life Science podcast. Today we have an interview branching out again from the plants and the animals that we've been comfortable with. And this time we're moving to a department that we haven't interviewed anyone in yet, the Department of Nutrition, Dietetics, and Food Science. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
That's okay. Exciting. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. So today we're joined by Dr. Raquel Richards and one of her research assistants, Kyle Lyman. And you know, we don't know a ton about the department or what the focuses are. I mean, food science, we can guess a little bit, but but maybe we'll start with intros and you can tell us a little bit about the department and how you got into that area of interest and also to BYU. We'll start with you, Dr. Richards.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a question a lot of people ask. What's the difference between nutrition, dietetics, and food science? How I explain it is nutrition and dietetics are both interested in thinking about what happens to food once it goes into the body. And some distinguishing features are maybe more the practice area and what you can do with those degrees. So with dietetics, a lot of our students they have to do an internship and have a supervised practice so many hours, and they sit for an exam to become a registered dietitian. And they now have to do that at a master's level. So our students can graduate with a dietetics undergraduate degree, but then they would have to then do a master's program to become a registered dietitian. And nutritional science, a lot of our students are interested in health professional school, so they might be pre-dent, pre-med, pre-PA, lots of pre's. And so I'm a nutritional science faculty member, but I'm also a registered dietitian, so I kind of see both worlds. Food science is interested in thinking about, I kind of say it like from farm to table, so thinking about what happens from agricultural production all the way to getting it to our table to consume. So it can be things like product development, it can be things like food safety, quality assurance to make sure your food is what you intend it to be, food labeling and policy. So a diversity of I'm probably not representing it very well. I have to bring a food science faculty member in. So like I mentioned, I'm a nutritional science faculty member and a registered dietitian, and I did not go to BYU as an undergrad. So I was at Utah State University. I studied nutrition science. I worked in a lab as a research assistant, doing more wet lab, kind of a lab bench work. We were isolating DNA from blood samples and also cheek cell samples. And then I had opportunity to work with some or other faculty who were doing more applied research. And so I got some exposure to both sides. I was a teaching assistant as well. So I had some experiences there. From there, I did a Master's of Public Health at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in New Orleans, Louisiana. I served a mission, too. So I served a mission in between my undergrad. Did a master's, did an internship in Atlanta, Georgia at the CDC, or Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And then I also did an intern with a place called Tuxco, which is Tulane Xavier National Center of Excellence in Women's Health. So my emphasis was maternal and child health. And then I went to University of Minnesota for my PhD in nutrition. So I really, when I was doing my master's in public health, I felt like we didn't talk enough about nutrition and health promotion. And I really wanted to combine both of those. And so I looked for programs to allow me to bring nutrition back into a realm of public health. So my dissertation at the University of Minnesota was looking at food access and the food environment and food choices among families experiencing homelessness. So that was my first exposure research. Well, no, that's not true. My master's, I had a little bit of exposure to food insecurity within children. And then I really got exposed kind of the reality of what it's like to live without housing. So housing insecurity along with food insecurity during my PhD. So how did I get to BYU? That's an interesting question. I actually did not plan on going to academia I mean, most people doing a PhD, that's kind of their route. I don't know what I thought a PhD was going to be, but I knew I wanted to do research. And at the CDC, I knew people who were in administrative positions who had either MDs or PhDs. And so I really saw myself going back to federal government and working more on programs at a more of administrative level. I had great support from the people at CDC, and they were looking out for jobs for me, and I was looking, and just nothing came up that really fit my expertise. And in the meantime, I actually got a phone call from BYU. So Merrill Christensen, yeah. So Merrill Christensen, who was a department, or no, he was this faculty search committee chair at that time, phone call out of the blue. Like, just answer the phone. He's like, I'm Merrill Christensen from BYU. We're looking to hire people over the next few years. Are you interested in applying? And this is 2 years into the PhD, and I'm like, I'm not even thinking about a job. You know, like, I'm just trying to wrap my head around the PhD and doing the research, you know. And he said he got my name from a faculty member at Utah State who I had was his TA as an undergrad, and he knew I was doing a PhD at the University of Minnesota. And so through that connection, they were able to get my name and contact information. And so I got this phone call, and I said, no, I'm not looking right now. And he said, well, what about in the next few years? Can I call you back? And I'm like, okay, yeah. I was totally flattered. Like, this faculty member remembered me and recommended me. And I seriously hung up that phone. I was like, he is not calling back. He was just being nice.
Yeah, because you've still got this big project ahead of you in a couple years at least. Yeah,
absolutely. So he did call back. Obviously, I'm here. So but he called back the next year. And by third year in, I'm really thinking now it's time to think about what am I doing next. And interesting, just a little side story. We at University of Minnesota, we were in the process of, as a PhD student, we had opportunity to interview someone who was applying for the department head position. And he was actually coming from a federal agency. So when I talked to him about my interest in going to a federal agency right after the PhD, he kind of said, you know, most of the people at federal agencies have academia experience. And that was kind of my first thought of like, oh, maybe it isn't the best route just to go right into into federal agency. So I applied for a few different types of jobs. And I will say that when I came to BYU, I distinctly felt like this is where I was supposed to be if I got offered the job. And when I did, I was like, there's my answer. Like that, this is where I'm supposed to be.
That's really cool. So how long have you been here?
This is my 16th year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been here a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes I forget. I feel like I just started yesterday and I'm like, oh, it's 16 years.
And so you haven't gone a different route, obviously. You like it enough to stay.
Oh, I love it.
Okay.
You know, I feel like that, since we're at BYU, we can talk about God, but I was going to say, I feel like that, to me, God knew where my strengths were at. And not that I don't think I could have done okay at the federal agency, but I don't think I knew then how much I would love working with students and teaching and mentoring. Like, to me, to be able to give back what I was given as a student is the most rewarding part of my job.
I love that. That's awesome.
Well, that brings us nicely then to one of your students.
Yes. So I'm Kyle. I'm an undergrad in nutritional science, and I've been Dr. Richard's RA since last January.
And RA, just for our listeners that might not know, is research assistant, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And where are you at in the program?
So I'm exactly halfway. I'm 2 years in to the nutritional science program. And kind of how I decided on that is, so at first I was a psychology major, and then I kind of realized I wanted to do pre-med, and I actually want to go to naturopathic medicine school. And so I thought that nutrition would be a great way to do that. It's something I've been interested in. I contracted Lyme disease about 3 years ago, and it's a lot of keeping up with your Lyme disease symptoms is having a good diet, and it causes certain allergies and intolerances in people. So I got super interested in that. And
just probably to manage your own health, right?
Yeah, exactly. I saw a naturopathic doctor, so I'm like, okay, I want to kind of do that myself. So I decided on doing nutritional science because it's kind of like a good medium between like, oh, I'm learning about science and nutrition, but also I'm preparing for med school, basically.
Yeah, really cool. So then, like, as a student in the program, what was it that then drew you to be interested in some research as well?
So Dr. Richards actually presented in one of my classes, and I thought her research seemed really interesting. She works with people transitioning into permanent housing, and she works with a lot of food insecurity stuff. So I was like, oh, this is super interesting. I sent her an email, and then the next semester I was one of her RAs.
That's great. That's awesome. So why don't you, either one of you, tell us a little bit more about this research. You said you work with the Food and Care Coalition here in Provo.
So I've kind of been on two projects with Dr. Richards. I'll talk about the transitional housing first. So more recently, we've been kind of focused on, we work with the Provo Food and Care Coalition, which is a place where people transitioning into housing can go to, correct me if I'm wrong, they can, it's kind of like a combination of like a food kitchen and also like they teach courses. Do they do anything else?
Yeah, so they have a soup kitchen, and then people who are, I guess, classified as being homeless can then live in this transitional housing, which is not considered permanent housing, but it's a way to transition them from being homeless to getting into permanent housing. And then they offer lots of different classes and resources. So one of the great things about the Food and Care Coalition is that Brent Crane, who is the executive director, he is all about bringing the services to the people rather than making the people go to multiple places. So mental health services, they have a clinic there. They bring lawyers in. They bring all sorts of resources in that they can then access. And we're just one piece of that to bring in nutrition.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. So we also work with Utah State Extension, and they teach a nutrition course there. And also with the help of Callie from BYU and some other people, we're all kind of working on a team to teach this nutrition class. And at the beginning of the class, we take anthropometric measurements. We take, which are like hip, waist, weight, body fat percentage. And we also take, they take surveys. We get accelerometer data. Am I missing
anything? Blood
pressure. Blood pressure.
We look at blood oxygen levels. Well, we can look at sleep with the pedometer as well as motion. And then we do a validated 24-hour recall to know what they're eating. I think that hits everything that we do in the measurements.
Yeah. So the reason we do that is because we kind of want to assess whether the course is working. Mm-hmm. And that's our research really, is we want to see whether this nutrition course is like affecting their lifestyles. And that's how we measure it.
So do you measure before the course and after, or?
Do the course is 12 weeks?
8 weeks.
8 weeks, okay. So we do it once at the beginning, and then we do it.
We do a midpoint, but the midpoint is not as all of those. It's just a kind of a check-in measure. And then at the end, we do all those measurements again. And then we are trying to do a two-month follow-up.
Okay.
But you can imagine with the individuals where they're in the process of transitioning to more permanent housing, the ability to follow this population over time is challenging, and it's why there's not a lot of studies doing long-term follow-up.
Yeah.
And normally we would want to follow up like 6 months to a year in a general population, but where this is a transient population, we want to be realistic, and so we brought that time frame down to 2 months. And Kyle's come in just like he's just starting on this project right now. So he's been through the first part, but hasn't had a chance to see kind of a whole, what we call a cohort, go through. And Callie is my graduate student. So she started this project this last spring.
That's a lot of data too that you're collecting.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you could answer some questions you don't even know you have yet with all that data.
Yeah, we've had a partnership with USU Extension before we received a grant to do kind of the research around this. So we were in the Food and Care Coalition. BYU is providing interns to help with the teaching, and then USU Extension was the main leader of the education. And then a grant opportunity came up that we were able to get funding to do more of a research scope project with unique measures that haven't been done before in this population. So it's pretty exciting for us from a research perspective, but also for me, I have been wanting to work with this population again. I haven't had a chance since I did my PhD in that with people experiencing homelessness. And then at BYU, we did secondary data analysis with a question looking at homelessness among women who reported experiencing that at 12 months prior to delivering a baby, so potentially through pregnancy is kind of how we frame that. But being back in the community, even if we don't find any significant differences, if we touch one person's life, which we already have, to me that's a win.
Yeah, that's a very fulfilling research because you actually can see some applications and see some results in people's lives. It's impactful.
And I love the relationships that you can build with individuals as well. And I think my RAs get more of that than I do this round. I haven't really been in the Food and Care Coalition, but it's amazing. My experience of being in the community is that it's
you build these relationships that are very meaningful. And for me, have changed my outlook on life and who I am today because of the people I've interacted with through research.
They have some great personalities there. They're super funny. Like literally all of them are super funny because they've just lived like a different life than we have. So it's really cool to see. And like she was saying, like it totally does change your perspective on just life.
Yeah. I'm sure you're seeing things from their eyes.
Yeah.
My question is then the idea of food insecurity among this community is understandable. What are some of those reasons that like if there's a soup kitchen at the Food and Care Coalition, what are the reasons might there be that they might be experiencing more significant food insecurities?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I say is it's complicated, but I'll tell some of the things. So when we first started doing this research, we knew that we needed to understand what those constraints were, like to talk to the people and find out what does your food environment look like? We didn't use those words, but like how do you obtain food and what are some of those barriers or challenges? And for my previous work, I kind of knew in my mind what might come up, but I also knew that this is a different state, a different location, so I don't want to make any kind of assumptions. What was interesting is that it was very similar, which tells me that there are similarities between what someone is experiencing when they have housing insecurity and food insecurity, which often go hand in hand. So what I would say is some of the reasons why you might still see food insecurity, even in a place where they have food that's there for them, is... one, what's the quality of food? So a lot of soup kitchens are relying on donations, and they do the very best they can to make foods tasty and appealing to their audience, but they are limited on what is available. So with those constraints, people have preferences still. Doesn't matter if you have a house or not, you still have preferences.
Yeah.
And okay. So if you are concerned about the quality of food, then maybe you, I guess what I would say too, is that maybe that's your only meal that you're having. And so having one or two meals a day, you may still feel like you are not getting the quantity or quality of food that you want. And also, if they aren't really, maybe in thinking about their, if they don't have a lot of economic, a lot of them work is what I would say, especially in transitional housing. I think most of them are working if they can, unless they have a physical disability. But then you think, well, if they don't have extra income or any kind of food assistance to help them to get food, or they don't have cooking places to cook the food, then you're really constrained with what you're able to do with food.
Right.
So I would say if you know where the Food and Care Coalition is, it's in South Provo, and it's a beautiful facility, but it's a food desert, meaning that is there a grocery store over there? There is not. However, Target is coming into the Provo Mall that's down there, so that maybe, but then you're like, well, is the cost going to be reasonable, and what is that going to look like? So I guess I'm just saying some of it is the food environment within where the facility is located.
Like the proximity,
yeah,
right?
The proximity, right? And so, and I would say with UVX, we have a little bit better transportation now, but transportation becomes a huge concern. I think about the scenario, you don't have a car, you're relying on public transit, which, okay, that could be useful. You know, you'd have to carry all your groceries. The reality of carrying groceries, think about a gallon of milk, your eggs, and you're on the bus or you're walking.
You can only do three or four bags.
Yeah, exactly. So you're buying, I mean, I have personal experience of doing this, and you buy smaller packages of food, you take backpacks, you take whatever you can to put food in there that you can carry. My experience, I luckily lived by a Walgreens, so I could buy milk and eggs, pay a little bit more money, but I wouldn't have to transport those 3 miles away from where I was living. So the reality is it's complicated. I think when you, if you've ever had an experience with not having a car, you get a little bit of perspective, but then imagine you don't have a car and you may not have a home base or a place to prepare food. It becomes very complicated to be able to get a healthy diet in.
So with the complexities of everyone being in their unique situation, right, we come back to like this idea of the one individual, if you can really make a change there. I guess, how do you balance that when it comes to the scientific side of this, like research, when you're collecting all these metrics and then you're trying to balance that with all these other variables where every individual in your study has different difficulties and different challenges in their life? How do you draw conclusions? How do you try and figure out what's really going on?
So I think that's why we did the formative research to begin with, so we could understand some of those constraints and modify the curriculum. So the curriculum is designed for households who are of low income, but their household to have a cooking, like a permanent housing. So we adapted it knowing that within the transitional housing units, they have microwaves, they do have a fridge. So they do have some things, but because of fire code, they can't have a stove or an oven. So they're very limited on preparation. So we modified it. Not all the recipes are ones you can make in the microwave or don't require any cooking, but we did incorporate some of those because we also acknowledge that they're transitioning to permanent housing. So yeah. We want to give them tips and tools to use once they transition into permanent housing. I'll just give you an example. One variable that we can't control is we can have someone who starts in the intervention and they're living in transitional housing, but during the 8 weeks, they transition into permanent housing. And so all of a sudden you have this new variable in there. We just have a lot of limitations that we're going to have to describe. And we'll see what we end up, it'll be interesting to see if we have any objective measures that change. Sometimes we know in research that maybe we don't see objective changes in like anthropometrics or blood pressure, but we might see attitudes change or perceptions change. And even that or knowledge, you know, things like that, that even is a start. So even if we don't see the objective, hopefully we can see some of those. And I should mention, too, at 2 months, we also are doing an interview, so qualitative work, because I also want to know their stories about, even if we only have a few, it's more than we have in the literature right now, to understand what are some of those challenges. You know, you've been through this program, now you're on your own. What does this look like for you? What are some of the facilitators? What are some of those barriers that have helped you to either keep doing the things you've been learning or have prevented you from being able to do that? And so far, we only have one person we followed up with, but, you know, and I think we only have 11 subjects. Like, we have a very small sample size. But to me, you don't always have to have a large sample size to be meaningful. We may not be able to show statistical differences, and that's one thing. But if we can even have some sense of, from a qualitative perspective, to me, that's valuable information to have. And again, it goes back to what I said earlier, which is, to me, it's a win if we just even affect one person's life for good.
Yeah.
As to, who cares about what ends up happening with the research?
It's really exciting. I love it.
So, Kyle, for you, as you've been involved in this research and research like this or programs like this in the department, what are some of the big takeaways that you've learned that you're going to like carry with you as you go on to like med school and things like that?
I think working with Dr. Richards, I've kind of more developed a liking for community nutrition versus like the super sciencey stuff. Cause I think like she's talking about, there's more of like an impact there. And obviously you can have an impact in whatever you do, but I kind of like the interpersonal connections from doing like a community nutrition sort of thing like this, because you actually get to interact with the people and develop those relationships.
And in some ways, I'm not surprised because I didn't realize you were psychology before.
Uh-huh.
Because the research we do in community bridges sociology and psychology. So my minor in my PhD was family social science because it just so closely paralleled with understanding kind of more of the psychological implications of what's happening within food insecurity and housing insecurity. So I'm not surprised you have found some interest in the applied side.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is going kind of right into as well, like why this kind of community work is important mm-hmm. to you. I mean, because there is always this other idea of like the more scientific, whether it's like benchtop chemistry or mm-hmm. science, why is the community work really important to each of you?
We all have a duty to help other people. And this is just like one way that we can do it is by helping other people in our community. A lot of people don't really know how to help out like a homeless person or someone transitioning into housing. It's not really an opportunity that a ton of people have. So I think it's important, like if I have it, that I should take it and kind of roll with it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I would say I have a huge appreciation of all areas of nutrition research. So my colleagues who do, you know, animal models, or they might work on some other type of cell model, the stuff they do is amazing, incredible work, so important to understand like disease prevention or treatment or mechanisms of what's happening in the body. I think that stuff, I mean, I wouldn't be a nutrition if I didn't think it was cool, but, and I had experience in undergrad too, and I thought that was amazing, like doing that side of stuff. But my real passion, even growing up, I've always been interested in helping people. And so even though I love that side of stuff and it's so important for our field, my passion is about helping people. And so I feel like when I did my PhD, the stories that I heard from children, you know, things like, I gave my $20 from my birthday to my parents because I knew we didn't have money for food. I mean, something like that, where I'm like almost in tears. You know, some of these stories, a child who's saying, I opened my fridge and we only had ketchup, and that's, I had bread and ketchup. That's what I ate. And I'm just like, whoa, like that was not my experience growing up. I mean, I didn't come from a super wealthy family, but it wasn't like I ever went without what I needed. And so hearing those stories, I was like, wow, I have a huge opportunity as a researcher to be the voice of people that sometimes don't get to share their voice, or don't, someone else is louder. And so I'm like, if I can be that person who disseminates it to the scientific community to make this, or the general public, to make this issue more, increase awareness, but also to bring reality to what it's like. Whether it's you know, college students experiencing food insecurity, which I worked on as well, or people experiencing homelessness, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about those kind of situations and what it looks like and what the experiences are. And sometimes it's seen as maybe more concrete of like, oh, they should just do X, Y, or Z, when it's much more complicated than that. And so if I can share that and help people to see a different perspective, to me, that's so rewarding. And again, I've always been the one, I'm like, I don't like when people are picked on. I don't like people to be vulnerable. I want them to be seen and heard.
I love that. And I think just your example of explaining how the proximity to food is complicated, this has been eye-opening for me, and I appreciate you guys sharing what you do.
I appreciate you guys as well. And you mentioned that you did some research on food insecurity among college students. We're here at BYU. For those who might be experiencing food insecurity, or maybe they're not aware that they are experiencing food insecurity, what resources are there? What might you say to those students?
Yeah, actually, there is a great website with BYU, foodandhousinginsecurity.byu.edu, and it's through the Dean of Students Office, and they have, you can, if anyone is experiencing housing insecurity, food insecurity, they can initially just contact the Dean of Students Office and they will get them connected with resources. But this website also provides community resources. So if someone is like, I kind of want to go off campus, there's resources that way. Being at BYU too, of course, because it's sponsored by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we also have local bishops. So you don't have to be, a student doesn't have to be a member of the church to talk to a bishop about getting resources for food and other things that they need to supplement kind of where they're at. I think it's great. I mean, I think that there's posters as well in the Wilk that asks if the students have concerns about housing or getting enough money for food, they refer them to the Dean of Students. So there are some resources just here locally they can use.
Well, great. And we'll include the link to that website in the show notes. And
great.
Is there anything else that you feel that we might be missing talking about?
I don't think so. Just thanks for being interested in our topic and wanting to interview us or do the podcast.
Oh, yeah. We're glad you came. And like Austin said, I'm a botanist and he's a soil guy. And so we are branching out and learning new stuff. And so we appreciate our perspectives being widened and learning from you both.
If someone's interested in participating in your research or helping out, is there ways for them to get involved, or what's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, so they should just send me an email and see if I'm taking any, if I have any openings, and it just changes. Sometimes I'll be like, I don't have anything. And then 2 weeks later, I'm like, oh, wait, I do have something now. So they can email me and I'll let them know if I have anything currently. And if I don't, I'll keep their name. So if I, when I do, I'll contact them and see if they're interested.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you to everyone for listening.